And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sidney Wildsmith.
As Charles Darwin's name keeps coming up as the debate over the teaching of intelligent design in science classes crescendos, it may be a good time to take a look at some of our ape ancestors. Just how smart are they? Can they actually talk? Do they plan and figure? Are they capable of using tools? These too are questions that are being debated. And in a moment, we bring you a special edition of the Wildside News as we go in-depth with one of the world's leading primate researchers. You will get some very powerful answers to these questions and more when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Science. Sometimes it's hard to know how exactly to react to science when it manifests in its purest forms. Certainly, that is part of what is inspiring the debate over Darwin's theory of evolution and now the movement by intelligent design advocates who are mounting campaigns to force its being taught in science classrooms in our public schools. It is a worthwhile debate. And now, as the president weighs in with his idea that he thinks it should be included in science classrooms, the issue is moving into the mainstream of media mayhem. Today, we offer another take on science as we go in-depth into the subject of animal intelligence with one of the world's leading primatologists, Dr. Dwayne Rumbaugh. His recent book, Intelligence of Apes and Other Rational Beings, speaks to the power of science, as you will see, to move through the tough issues and emerge into a new expanded awareness that I'm sure you will find interesting. Sometimes it feels as if I'm caught between two worlds. It's no secret that I have a passion for promoting the concept that animals are exceptional beings with great abilities and wonder. And a comforting truth is that almost anyone who has a pet, particularly a dog, or a reasonable cat, or a larger bird like a parrot, will tell you in no uncertain terms that yes, animals are really intelligent. Take a moment to talk with a dog owner about their pet, and you will soon hear a series of amazing stories of their sensitivity, cleverness, loyalty, and intelligence. But the other side of this story is that science, for a long time, has held to the belief, much growing from the legacy of Darwin and evolution, that animals could not have real intelligence because, well, for example, in order to think and reason, they would have to have the use of words. And we all know they don't use words. And when we assign human characteristics to animal behavior, we are anthropomorphizing. Well, today's feature is a wonderful story of science and the quest for truth. It's a story of the evolution of scientific understanding, where pure science explores the question of animal intelligence. There is a giant opportunity for all of us to learn what happens when science, pure science, holds to the quest. This just may be one of the most significant stories presented so far on the Wildside News, and I invite you all to take this journey of discovery. You will be glad you did. We're talking with Dr. Dwayne M. Rumbaugh, who co-authored the book Intelligence of Apes and Other Rational Beings with Dr. David A. Washburn. The book is published by Yale University Press. Dr. Rumbaugh, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you.
You're working with the Great Ape Trust, and I certainly would like to start out with you giving a little heads up on what's happening with the Great Ape Trust, because this is ultimately where what we're going to talk about today has led you.
Well, the Great Ape Trust is a great adventure. We are trying to organize a new entity that will give a new and effective message to the world about the importance of our world of nature, using the great apes really as our point of focus. The great apes are so closely related to us, so much alike in their mentality, though different somewhat in their morphology from us, that we really need to put emphasis on conserving them in nature so that their culture, their modes of living will be available forever for subsequent generations to study and to learn from. We can conserve them in captivity, but we really deprive ourselves, if that's our only access to them, to learning about how it is that they live in nature. And that's a very important book for us to continue reading.
I believe that, as a matter of fact, that's what your research has led to, is that conclusion that is the importance, that they be allowed to exist in their natural environments for reasons that we'll get into. How did you come to be so involved with researching intelligence in apes?
It's a long and interesting story. As a boy, I loved animals, particularly dogs. I worked on the farm during World War II and pretty much lost my love of animals, and then animals on the farm are basically food products and beasts of labor, at least they were then. We were still using horses a lot. And then when I went to college and to graduate school in psychology, I came to be intrigued with the process of learning and learning theories. Learning theories then emphasized reinforcement, that the reinforcement of responses really in some way bonded responses and behavior to stimuli or to environmental events, and that organisms basically were empty without rational processes. And there's a lot of power to be exercised through the use of reinforcement or through manipulating the consequences of behaviors. But I felt at the time that there still was something incomplete in that the magnificent work of Curler and Yerkes were viewed pretty much as points of intrigue, but nothing to be taken too seriously other than ways of thinking in the course of history. Now, both Curler and Yerkes were of the opinion that the great apes were different and that they had the capacity of insight, of basic reasoning processes. And this stood in contrast to the radical behavioral thinking of theorists of that time, earlier Thorndike and Watson, and then Skinner and Hull, and in measure Tolman, though he was far more rational in his perspective of animals' behavior than were the others. But at any rate, I got my master's degree in experimental psychology from Kent State, and then my PhD from University of Colorado at Boulder, studying with students of K.W. Spence of the University of Iowa. Spence was the main disciple of Clark Hull, who of Yale University advanced the concept of the development of habit strength and stimulus-response connections, reinforcement of responses through need reduction, and so on. With my PhD in hand, I went to work with San Diego State College, as it was then called, in 1954. And various interesting events of history led me to apply for a direct commission in the United States Navy, which I got in 1957 or 58, and then was on duty at the Naval Research Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland, right alongside of the Naval Hospital there. And that summer, I worked with Lieutenant Bob Vos on a project to put some kind of biological experiment in space. That introduced me to work with small primates, squirrel monkeys and cotton-top marmosets. I decided that I was at the ripe old age of 28, too old to convert from a college professorial life to that of the United States Navy, so I didn't go for a career in the Navy. I went back to my teaching job and went to the San Diego Zoo not far away with a new perspective, namely of wanting to better understand the great apes and the evolution, the emergence of intelligence in the primate forms that they had in their beautiful collection of primates, ranging from prosimians to New World monkeys, Old World monkeys, the lesser apes, and the great apes. I took my class down there frequently to look at the primates and almost invariably invited Dr. George Purnell, an anthropologist and curator of the mammals at the zoo. I invited him to talk with us about the primates, and he was just great always. When he would move from the prosimians and the monkeys to the lesser apes and then to the great apes, something of an ascending scale of an approximation of what we are, he would always say, as he would point to the great apes, he said, "Well, now these are thinking animals." And I always thought to myself, "Oh, yeah, yeah, George, they're thinking animals, all right. Animals can't think. They don't have language. They're not human. It's all conditioned responses. It's all based on reinforcement." But I never said that to him out of respect.
You know, scientists are almost confined to that to that response.
Yes,
your response.
Yes, yes. We had indeed been strongly reinforced.
The concept that animals, you know, any time that someone might suggest, you might suggest that animals have feelings or awareness, then the charge of anthropomorphizing would hit you, and that's a killer.
That was a killer then, and it's less of a killer now. But to it, I always like to reply, well, we anthropomorphize with one another all the time as humans. I don't really know that you are a rational being. I don't know that really that I'm talking with anybody who is other than some kind of a biological invention from outer space.
Some people claim that is the case with me at times, yeah.
we each assume that we are rational beings, that we are sentient, that we have logic, that this and that and the other, but that's really, really on faith, and really groundless assumptions. We make the bold assumption that what people say is really what they mean, and that is risky. Many times we say what we don't mean. This morning I've spent a lot of time communicating with a friend, clarifying a point of psychology that I was trying to make yesterday. And I've had a lot of fun doing it with him and he with me. It's part of our professional exchange.
Well, getting back to this concept of your beginnings in the research into intelligence, and I really appreciate this book is a very honest story of your emergence into your beliefs about animal intelligence. And it's really, to me, it's fascinating because at that time, as you began to work at the San Diego Zoo, you approached this from almost a Skinnerian, and you'll be better at defining the approach, but you really felt that you had to use very extremely controlled testing, and so you began with apes in laboratories.
Yes, and I did, but it was really much more of a Harlovian approach at that point. I had become disinterested in Hull's reinforcement perspective about 1956 as I worked with rats. I just finally gave up, concluding that it wasn't going to work with me, that the rats were always learning more than I did. I could not predict accurately the outcome of an experiment. But in 1949, Harry Harlow at the University of Wisconsin came forth with his phenomenon of learning set, learning how to learn. And it was brilliant work in that he showed with rhesus macaque monkeys, with macaque monkeys, not all of which were rhesus, that they could be transformed, if you would, from stimulus response reinforcement learners to one trial insightful learners, with a one trial insightful learning being one of the criteria for really curlers and Yerkes, insightful learning for their creativity in their behaviors. So this intrigued me, and I set about to study the formation of learning sets in primates from prosimians through the great apes. And that took 10 years to do. In fact, it continued well beyond there. But some very interesting things came forth from there. The animals taught me some things that just couldn't possibly be true in how they would develop learning sets. And if I may risk translating the basic lesson into words, and it's difficult always to do, it is that as the various primate forms learned increasing amounts in terms of accuracy of choices correct in a situation, they differed markedly in terms of how they could transfer that learning to subsequent situations in which there was some change. The situation to which they transferred was similar to and yet different from the one in which they learned. And this remarkable phenomenon was first seen by work with I and my colleague at the San Diego Zoo when I was on sabbatical leave and took a look at the results with squirrel monkeys. On the one hand, a very diminutive New World monkey compared to that of the great apes with the same procedures. Namely, that as the amount of their learning increased, the squirrel monkeys invariably did worse on their transfer tests. Learning more for them cost them in terms of their accuracy of performance in the transfer tests. To the contrary, with the great apes, the more they knew, the more probable it was that they would do not really just as well. They would do better on the transfer test than what they had done in the original learning situation.
Let me just give a little background, too, because I think painting a picture here would help the listeners really appreciate what the type of experience. You worked in a laboratory environment where you created lexigraphs that were little boxes that could help the monkeys and apes make choices. And so some of the first levels was just to prove that an animal could recognize different shapes and forms. And yes. I mean, it was very fundamental, but because it was science, you had to start with fundamentals. And so you were really just trying to suggest in the initial research that animals could actually recognize anything.
It was known that they could recognize things, but what wasn't known was that as they learned how to learn, as they developed, if you will, proficiency in learning tasks of a given type, it wasn't known that they really differed all that much. And my study was designed to see whether or not they did. And they did differ profoundly. And the larger the primate brain, and here we're talking about species, not individuals, the better they were at transferring what they had learned from one situation to another. And there was this stark contrast that the great apes could be significantly better in transferring what they've learned, whereas for the small-brained primates, they were significantly worse in their transfer tests.
Help people understand what that means, this concept of transfer.
I was just going to say what we mean by that. Let me use an example here to everyday life. When we drive cars of different makes, there is fundamentally positive transfer from one make to another. We know that the key will go in some slot generally to the right of the steering wheel. We know that there is a shifting mechanism of some kind, generally, though with the new hybrids, I guess that's going out, I don't know. We know that there is a brake that is foot controlled, and that it's with the right foot, not the left foot. And so on, and that there's an accelerator. If it weren't that cars are fundamentally designed the same way, it would be impossible for us to slip into a new car and to drive it without a lot of lessons. Now, as we made a shift in cars from having the gear shift mechanism on the floor to on the steering wheel, there was a lot of negative transfer. People weren't used to finding first gear when the shifting mechanism was on the steering wheel. When it became automatic, that became really no problem. But sometimes the the transfer was negative, and thus I remember very definitely, and I'm sure everybody does, who learned how to drive in cars that had a clutch on the floor and a brake on the floor, and we had to press the clutch in before we shifted gears. When the clutch was taken out of the car and we wanted to shift gears, we found our left foot flailing around down there for a pedal that just wasn't there. Well, that's negative transfer.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had to shift our attention to, well, how is it now that we shift gears?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes transfer can be so negative that it takes lives. When I was in the Naval Reserves, I knew of a pilot who creamed in with his fighter jet one weekend. And the reason that it happened in the post-accident analysis was that the flap mechanism was where the throttle had been on the previous plane that he had really been an accomplished flyer in and with. And as he made his approach to landing, he needed more power. Instead, he applied more flaps, and that cost him support that he had, and he stalled and crashed in. So positive and negative transfer are basic to our lives.
One of the things I think would be interesting is to kind of, as I say, you started out with very basic research, just trying to indicate that these animals had some level of comprehension. But
yes.
Then your book certainly chronicles the way in which, as you experimented, you know, over years with the different animals,
yes.
that you began to, first of all, begin to prove, as well as sense, that there was a lot more going on. And we can kind of take this to the next step. For example, some people have said, well, can animals use tools? Or can animals actually understand language? Or do they have a language?
Yes.
Obviously, if they were just beast machines, the theory was they couldn't or
yes.
they wouldn't. So tell us about some of the breakthroughs for you as you moved through the years that would lead to your own beliefs about those things.
Mm-hmm. Just one more comment on the positive-negative transfer, because it's absolutely basic here.
Mm-hmm.
If an organism, especially a non-human organism, can transfer what it learns in one situation to another to a profound advantage, doing better in it than what it had done in the original learning situation, that strongly suggests that it has some comprehension of what it has learned,
mm-hmm.
that it's learned principles and not specifics.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's
by
not
contrast,
just reacting.
If an animal mm-hmm. does less well in the transfer test mm-hmm. than what it did in the original learning, it strongly suggests that it's learned specifics and really can't generalize what it's learned in any kind of a rational or principled way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is absolutely basic, I believe, to the emergence of intelligence and to language and to tool use and to every other manifestation that we view as inventive. We know that animals can use tools. They can create tools. Through the work of Sue Savage Rumbaugh, we know that Kanzi, a bonobo ape, a form of chimpanzee, can make stone tools that are of the kind that early humans made. To cut meat, to skin animals, to do this and that. And he learned it by imitation. That is really not just imitation. He learned it by observing Professor Nick Toth and Kathy Schick from Indiana University making tools out of flint. He developed all of the finesse not by the specifics of watching them, but by starting with what he could see them do. And then his own experience taught him how to really make a fine flint tool. Now, that is profound for an animal to do. Neither Sue nor anybody else other than Nick Toth thought that an ape might make a stone tool like that.
That's extraordinary.
But they can. They can do all kinds of things. They can learn some of the aspects of language. Now, there's a big quarrel in the field. There has been for the past half century. Well, you know, it really isn't language because humans can do this and they can do that. Well, I would hope that they can. You know, apes' brains are about the third of the size of ours, and they are apes, they're not humans. But the really exciting thing is that there is some overlap in our language capabilities and what the great apes can learn. Not from being taught as though they were beast machines, but by being reared as though they're something they're not. Namely, being reared in part as though they were a child.
You know, why don't we take a short break, and when we come back, let's start to go into those realms, because those become so fascinating and really take us into the next level. So when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Dr. Rumbaugh.